Welcome to Beyond the Sirens, our podcast series designed for paramedics who are called to urgent palliative and end-of-life care situations. The aim of the series is to start a journey together, raising awareness of the holistic and complex needs of end-of-life care.
We want to support you in helping patients and relatives make the best decisions for those who are dying and for those left behind.
During the series, we have drawn upon the wisdom of seasoned experts in this field. We are committed to equipping you with the tools and insights needed to make a meaningful difference to the lives of the patients and those that they love. I am Mary Buttle, a registered nurse with extensive experience in the fields of oncology and palliative and end-of-life care, and a wealth of experience in teaching and training in these areas.
And I'm Tessa Taylor, also a registered nurse. I, however, have been in palliative and end-of-life care for a very long time. So for those of you who've heard of Florence Nightingale, we were classmates. During this time, I have also been involved in teaching paramedics. Hi, everybody, and welcome to episode 5 of our podcast series. We're delighted today to be joined by Edward O'Brien, who's a McMillan paramedic and clinical lead for palliative and end-of-life care in the Welsh Ambulance Services NHS Trust. Ed will share with us some of the amazing initiatives in Wales that could be implemented in other parts of the country.
Oh, thanks, Tessa. It's great to be in the studio with you.
Yeah, thanks for being with us today, Ed. I'm just wondering, to get us started, if you could share some of your really amazing innovations that you've put into place in your new role.
Oh, wow. Okay. So I guess the first one that comes to mind is the Wish Ambulance. So the Wish Ambulance is an idea that we had that actually stemmed from our rapid transport service, our end-of-life care rapid transport service, but I'll go back to that. So the Wish Ambulance is essentially a pool of volunteers made up of ambulance clinicians from within Welsh Ambulance or WAST who give up their days off to support terminally ill patients to experience a meaningful journey. So these are patients who are likely in their last days or weeks of life and who have expressed a desire to go somewhere or a wish that they could have done something. And an example might be that they wish they could have gone home for one last time to see their garden, or it may be that they wish they could have gone to watch their children's concert or attended a wedding or seen a sporting event. And so we will try and make that happen. So if they can get there under their own steam, if you like, if they can, you know, wheelchair and taxi, they don't need us. So the patients that we're supporting are the patients who've become too poorly to do that. These are the patients who are now bedbound. So we'll sort of convey them to these places on a stretcher. And obviously we've got all different clinical grades, so we're able to support them clinically as well as support them with that transport. It's not a service that's advertised. Therefore, every single wish is a genuine wish. I don't mean that to sound harsh, but I think if you see an advert, you may start thinking, well, what should we do? Where's this? Yeah. Because it's not advertised, the only people that know about it are the people who can feed it in. So it's only healthcare professionals that can feed these wishes in. So that's your specialist palliative care teams, your GPs, people like that, district nurses. So because the people who are saying, I wish I could have done this, don't know that actually there's a service to do that, it's a genuine wish, for want of a better description. So that's one of our services that we've introduced. And that came in 2019 originally. Had to pause it during COVID for obvious reasons. And then we started it back up again then sort of towards the end of 2022. I think we're coming close to about 55 wishes in total, which, you know, you could argue isn't a huge amount, but 55, that's 55 journeys that wouldn't have happened. And the impact that that's had on relatives and friends has just been enormous, because every wish is done. I mean, I've had the privilege of being on a number of wishes, and you see the family members and friends, just the laughter, the smiles that happen during those wishes, and they've got that memory forever. So it has a massive impact on far more than just the patient themselves.
Okay, Ed, so you're saying that these are volunteer paramedics, so on your days off?
Yes, so these are paramedics, emergency medical technicians, and sort of ambulance care assistants, so it can be any grade, and then we'll kind of match the the required clinical grade to the requirement of the patient. So if it's a patient who's got no clinical need whatsoever, they just need transport, then, you know, it could be any clinical grade, or if they need, you know, perhaps injectable medications, you know, syringe drivers running, et cetera, we'll put a paramedic on the crew.
Okay then. So if people who are listening would like to get involved with this, you know, other paramedics, is this just in your Wales area then, or is it anywhere else in the country?
Yes. So this is a Welsh Ambulance Initiative. And so we support any patient within Wales to do a wish. We'll take them outside of Wales if that wish can be done within a day. So we don't do overnight stays. But it's only patients within Wales that can be fed in. The dream is that every other ambulance service mirrors this, and this becomes something available throughout the UK. But unfortunately, I don't have the power to be able to get other ambulance services to do such a thing. So Welsh Ambulance have been amazing. So they support us with, you know, all the sort of the essentials, i.e. they provide the vehicle, they fund the fuel, any consumables, and they make sure insurance is covered, etc. So even though these are people on their days off, they're still covered by the full insurance that they would be if they were in work.
So any of these paramedics listening to our podcast who think, oh, this is something I'd like our trust to do, what top tip would you share with them to encourage them to move it forward?
Oh, that's tricky. So I guess I should say that we've got an end of life care leads group. So that's a national group where representatives of nearly all of the 13 ambulance services will send somebody, and we share ideas. You know, it's very much, you know, this is what we're doing, how can we help you with this? And so I know there are a number of other ambulance services where their leads are currently trying to see what can be done. So you never know. Maybe people listening, it might be coming to their area anyway.
That'd be amazing if it was.
Yes, it would, yes.
When I hear you talk about your wish service, Ed, I can really hear the passion and the pleasure it gives you to be part of that. How does it help in terms of the team morale and well-being?
You raise a really good point. The positive impact it's had on well-being of staff has been enormous, and that was an unexpected bonus. So we actually geared up when we first designed this, and we designed this in collaboration with colleagues within specialist palliative care. We started looking at, you know, we think this will be really difficult. We need to make sure the support services are in for our staff for afterwards. But actually it was the complete opposite. It's almost, this is the support service, the positive influence this has on them. Because obviously whenever somebody volunteers for a wish, they'll always get a phone call at the very least from somebody within the wish team to say, you know, how's things? Are you okay? And one of the first things they always say is, when can I do another one? It's absolutely amazing, because I think people perhaps before they've done a wish think, oh gosh, that might be quite a distressing or upsetting time, but it's the complete opposite. It's just fun and laughter. It's really positive.
Is it
positive.
Just the paramedics, Ed?
So it's anybody within Welsh Ambulance Service who is able to, who's able to work on a vehicle, so who's done their moving and handling,
etc.
That
means you have to move to Wales,
I know. I'm just sitting here, Ed, thinking, oh, I want to come. But as a nurse, so what I'm just thinking about, you know, if there are any nurses or doctors or healthcare who are listening in, who think, do you know, I'd like to help. That's why I was just wondering, would they be able to contact you, or do you have to be a paramedic?
So to be on the Wish Ambulance crew for insurance reasons, you have to be trained to use our vehicles, if that makes sense, and, you know, to use the tail lift and the stretcher and all things like that. So it has to be an ambulance crew. But there's been more than one occasion where we've actually not been able to match the right clinical grade for the wish, because, you know, as I say, we're very reliant on people giving up their days off, and people can't always do that. So there was one a few months ago where a gentleman's last wish was to walk his daughter down the aisle. She was getting married. He was very, very poorly in hospital, and he just didn't think that was achievable. And it was in a part of Wales where we perhaps haven't got the most volunteers, because it was quite a rural part of Wales. We were able to put a crew together, but we weren't able to offer a paramedic. And due to his clinical needs, it needed that paramedic. However, we couldn't say, look, we're not doing it. So very kindly, one of the clinical nurse specialists, one of the CNSs, said, do you know what? I'll give up my day off. So we actually had three on that crew. So we had the two ambulance crew to ensure we ticked that box of, you know, we've got the right people for the manual handling, et cetera. And the clinical nurse specialist was then able to come along and manage his clinical needs. And they had a fantastic day. Really, really good. So, and then he died a few days afterwards, but having achieved his wish, you know, everyone thought he'll probably only manage probably an hour at best, and then he's going to be so poorly, so worn out, we'll have to take him back. He actually managed about 4 or 5 hours. He even managed to sign the wedding register for his daughter and everything, so they had a whale of a time.
And you know, Ed, we've been talking on previous podcasts about the impact of how somebody's cared for at the end of their life, how that impacts on the people who were bereaved, who were left behind. And I can imagine that for the daughter and for the rest of the family of that gentleman to be able to have experienced that would have, if possible, a positive impact on their grieving.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think this is really, really helping with bereavement. It's given them really happy memories, as opposed to, you know, the last few days or weeks being not such a positive time. You know, they can look back. And equally, I suspect, I'm only guessing, but I suspect, so we get a lot of people who want to see the beach for one last time. That seems to be a really popular wish. And I suspect that people who have used the Wish Ambulance Service previously probably make a bit of a pilgrimage to that beach a year later, or perhaps even every year, or, you know, on the same date. And I suspect they, you know, just go and have a bit of time there. And I would imagine that has a positive effect on them.
So far reaching implications of what you're doing, really. Positive impacts in so many ways.
Yeah, potentially what we're all doing in the ambulance service. So yeah, I mean, there's lots of us involved in it. So, you know, we got a Wish team. So
I'm coming. So that was the Wish Ambulance. So what else have you been doing, Ed?
Okay, so I mentioned very briefly there that this kind of came off the back of the End of Life Care Rapid Transport Service. So that was a service we set up in 2017. Essentially, we identified that when a person is dying and they're not where they want to be, i.e. they're not in their preferred place of death, what a lot of healthcare professionals had the misconception of is, if we need to move them quickly, if we make a 999 call, that will be the quickest option. Now, within the Welsh Ambulance Service, we work to a clinical response model. So it's not about who rang first, it's about what's the highest clinical priority. You know, there's only so many ambulances, but an awful lot more calls. Now, something like a chest pain, a cardiac arrest, a choking patient, they're always going to go to the top of the queue. So, you know, regrettably, the patients who absolutely are just as important but need to be transferred to their preferred place of death are always going to be a lower clinical priority. And so we were seeing incidents where we were either arriving, you know, in the middle of the night or 3 o'clock in the morning, as opposed to during the day, you know, and that poses problems if you go into a hospice, for example, for things like clarking. But equally, we also saw incidents where we didn't get there in time. And so we thought, well, we need to prioritize these calls, but how do we prioritize them? And it was a really, really simple solution. So for, you know, there was a few of us involved in this. Again, it's not just me. So as a little team of us, we sort of worked out that actually, if we used our non-emergency patient transport service, so these are the people who, you know, the ambulance care assistants who do the outpatients appointments and discharge runs, actually, we could make this their highest priority call. So we could never make it a high priority call in 999 worlds, but we could for them. So with their ambulances, they're kind of a mixture of either a minibus configuration or a stretcher type vehicle. So any stretcher vehicle becomes a virtual pool, if you like. It becomes part of the virtual pool, and they're available. So as and when a call comes in, and we get around about 5 to 10 a day. So it has to be a patient who's considered to be in their last days to hours of life, who needs transport to their preferred place of death. Basically, we'll dispatch that ambulance, that non-emergency ambulance, to go and do that run, because these are patients who don't need clinical input. Yeah. These are patients who just need, you know, safe and professional transport. And so, you know, our average response time is just under an hour. So, you know, that's pretty decent. So you know, so now we've got CNSs or doctors or whoever ringing up saying, we need this person to come into the hospice, or perhaps they've been into hospice, but actually they want to go home to die. You know, we can usually transport them within about an hour, getting them to their preferred place of death. And it's that service that, from where the Wish was born, because doctors and nurses became used to this really, really useful service. And one of the doctors said to us once, look, I know it's not what you're there for, but we've got this lady who just keeps saying she wishes she could see her local beach with her kids one more time. Is there any way we could use the End of Life Care Rapid Transport for it? So that's kind of how it happened, because we ended up doing that one particular journey. And we saw the positive impact it had, not only on the patient and the family, but actually on the staff of the hospice, because they were talking about it's just lifted everybody's spirits, because now, you know, this lady lived for a number of days afterwards, and apparently everybody was talking about the great day they had at the beach, as opposed to it being a bit more of a, no one really knows what to say anyone, but this lady's dying, family didn't know what to say to staff. They just had this common bond to talk about a positive thing. And so after that one job, that was where we thought, we can't make that a one-off. And that's how the Wish Ambulance was
amazing,
born.
Isn't it?
I think to have that response time of 1 hour is incredible. You know, we do have windows of opportunity, but so often we can miss those opportunities. And that can mean that someone doesn't die in their preferred place. You know, they don't get to get home. They don't get to go to the hospice because we've missed that opportunity. So having that window of just 1 hour is amazing to be able to respond so rapidly to that. Really makes we have these important conversations, don't we, about preferred place of care and death. But we do know as healthcare professionals that sometimes it may not happen. But when you've got a response rate that's only 1 hour, it really increases the chance of that occurring.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I should say we don't promise an hour, but when we audited the last one, it was just under an hour, which was amazed us. So, you know, we sort of say, look, we'll try and get it done within a few hours, but actually we're doing better than, we're overachieving, shall we say. But then people have got used to it now. And if you don't turn up within a couple of hours, you get a phone call saying, where are they?
Yeah, it's really good, lovely service. Yeah, and I've also understand Ed, that you have anticipatory drugs on your ambulances for patients at end of life, is that right?
Yes, so we've introduced just in case medications onto every ambulance in Wales. We actually did that in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. So at the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, when it was first hitting our shores and we were hearing the horror stories that were coming into us predominantly from Italy, basically Welsh government informed Welsh Ambulance that, you know, this is what's coming. Here's the data. Here's what we're thinking may happen. So no one was saying it will happen. But you know, when it was kind of presented to me then, it was almost a potential doomsday scenario of ITUs and, you know, filling up and paramedics being required to palliate people with severe COVID in the community who ordinarily would be eligible for the intensive care units, the ITUs, but because they're full, they wouldn't be able to. So we were being told that potentially paramedics may be required to do this. And we're thinking, well, if we're taking on such a task, we need to ensure that they've got the medications to support them to do that. So whereas most things in the NHS tend to take quite a long time, shall we say, and many governance routes, the red tape was kind of cut during COVID. You know, there wasn't many good things that came out of COVID, but that was certainly one of them, that we were able to actually do things and progress things a lot quicker. And so from the time where we had this first conversation of, do you know what, just in case medications on ambulances may be appropriate, because these people with severe COVID, if they've not already had a diagnosed end-of-life condition, they're not going to have their own just-in-case meds. Why would they? So we need to provide them. So from the time where we thought that would be a good idea to the time where they appeared on ambulances was around about 2 weeks. Can you imagine doing that now outside of COVID? But when we worked out what medications we needed, again, using the emerging data coming out from Italy and Association of Palliative Medicine guidelines and recommendations, the medications that were suitable for COVID are actually also really suitable for all our other sort of other conditions. Your common symptoms, your breathlessness, your pain, your agitation, your respiratory secretions. You know, your nausea, vomiting, etc. So we carry five different just-in-case meds. It was originally a temporary solution during COVID, but obviously we did a huge amount of data collection during it. And the data collection showed that actually COVID was the third reason we most used it. So end-stage frailty and cancer are the main reasons that we have been using just-in-case meds. So actually, if the data's showing that it's been really safe and effective, why would we take them away? So it's now become a business as usual and it's available for and any paramedic. So it's not specialist paramedics or our palliative care paramedics, or it's any qualified paramedic, because the training is mandatory in how to use them. So every paramedic is able to do that.
That's really interesting to hear, because, you know, we've said before, across the country, I can imagine policies vary, don't they? And not every ambulance crew have this service available to them. And a lot of medics say, you know, there's quite often no medication in the house, or relatives have got to go midnight to emergency pharmacists to fetch it. And, you know, and there again, that's time that there isn't a lot of. So, you know, I can imagine that it's managed to, again, just improve the end of that, that person's life just by being able to manage those symptoms that they may be having at that time.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And from a data point of view, I'm someone who loves data and is constantly collecting data. So end-of-life care is around about 9% of what we do in the Welsh Ambulance Service. But I can't say confidently this is correct, but I would suspect that's similar for all other UK ambulance services, because we all tend to do kind of the same thing. 9% of those patients, you know, so we did a four-year data trawl, not during COVID, because that would have skewed the figures. So we looked at pre-COVID. And yeah, 9% of our work on average is to a patient who is in their last year of life as a result of a terminal condition, so a palliative or advanced condition. And we know they're in the last year because we work backwards. So there's a lot of data fed together in Wales. We're really lucky how we can pull data from emergency departments and from death records and tie them all up with ambulance service data. So we kind of work backwards. We looked at, you know, everybody who died, and then worked, okay, how many times did they hit ambulance service, how many times they hit ED, etc. So 9% may not sound a huge number, but to give that some context, major trauma, which I think most people would think that's what ambulance services do a lot of, is 2% of our work. And when you think about, you know, if you're watching Casualty and they got their helicopters and their critical care doctors and all that, and that's great, we've got all that as well, but actually that's only for 2% of our work. So really the investment needs to now be in the other things like end-of-life care. And that's where Welsh Ambulance Service have really sort of recognized that and have said, look, we really need to get better at this. And hopefully we're on track to do that. So
Well done.
In terms of the other data, you mentioned about, you know, people who are coming right to the end of their life. So when we first introduced Just In Case Meds, we looked at, so within the first 12 months, and there's a paper, we just published a paper out there now. It's via the Journal of Paramedic Practice. If anybody wants to read it, it's on open access. And that's the impact of paramedics using just-in-case medications. We identified that, I think, 68% of all the patients that we had to use just-in-case meds on, whether they were ours or patient's own, so, you know, if the patient's got their own, we'll use them in preference to our own, were in their last 48 hours of life. So that shows the real crisis point, you know, what the paramedics are managing. You know, they are managing literally the last hours to days of life. You know, this isn't patients who have, you know, sort of months or weeks left.
So I'm just wondering, with what you said there, Ed, how did paramedics feel about this change in practice in terms of having just-in-case medicines on the ambulance and administering them?
I'd say the vast majority welcome it. There's always going to be one or two who are a little bit, you know, is this our role? And I get that, and that's okay to question that. You know, it's probably not what you believe you will be doing when you finish joining the ambulance service. But then actually, when you're faced with that situation and you access those meds and you see the positive effect they can have, you know, those people who may have doubted it initially will soon say, crumbs, we should have had these years ago. So overwhelmingly, it's been very positively received, not just by our staff, but by obviously, you know, partner agencies as well, because, you know, GPs, GP out of hours, palliative care teams, you know, these are all their patients as well. So
as we said before, you know, we've only got one chance to get it right, and these details make all the difference, don't they? They ease the symptom burden and make those last moments of people's lives more comfortable.
Yeah, 100%. So most importantly, it gets them symptom relief quicker than that would have happened previously. But I guess secondly, it's massively reduced the avoidable hospital admissions. You know, nobody wants to spend their last few hours, or I shouldn't say nobody, but I would imagine the majority of us don't want to spend our last few hours or days in hospital if we can avoid it. And this has helped to do that.
Yeah, amazing. Thank you for that, Ed. I'm just wondering if you could spend some time just telling us about your palliative care paramedics rotation that you put in place. Because again, that's another amazing initiative that you started.
Yeah, so it's early days on that. So I'm not going to sort of say we've got them all over Wales at this point. That's the dream. That's where we want to head. But at the moment, we're still growing that number. So yeah, absolutely. Aim high. So essentially, we sort of start, I say we, so the small team of us that do end of life care within the ambulance service, we've spotted a gap, for want of a better description. All this data's coming in, we're seeing all this thing that's happening, we're thinking, well, if critical care's, you know, got all these specialist type people and it's only 2%, it probably is a little bit of a market, a little bit of a gap for specialists within palliative and end of life care. You know, paramedics who will have that extra bit of skills and knowledge in relation to that, you know, the more holistic type approach to patient care. And so we're toying with these ideas, and then you've got a health board, then the clinical lead for one of the specialist palliative care team completely coincidentally contacted me and said, Ed, do you know what? I think paramedics could do a job in our team. And that's kind of where the idea then just went, well, do you know what? Let's try and do this together. How about we share paramedics? Because all the skills and knowledge that they'll get working within your specialist palliative care team, they'll then bring back to 999 world. So they've got the benefit of having these, time-served, knowledgeable, skilled paramedics. But the fact that they rotate between WAST and the specialist palliative care team, so you'll never spend more than a week outside of one, because they do four on, four off, basically. So they'll do, you know, four shifts in palliative care, 4 days off, four shifts in WAST, and then continue that way. They keep all their generalist skills as well. I think, you know, so we know that, you know, some hospices in England have taken on paramedics over the years, but they've taken them on full time. And there's that risk of skill fade. If you're just doing palliative and end of life care, you're going to get really good at that, but you're perhaps going to get skill fade in all the generalist paramedic skills that will equally bring a lot of benefit to these patients as well. So yeah, it's benefited both sides. And the way they work in currently within WAST is actually they're still generalists for us. But that's why I was a bit late coming to this studio today. I'm so sorry, because we've got an urgent meeting, because as of January, they're going to be doing a specialist role within WAST, because, you know, winter pressures, etc. You know, everybody's saying, how can we make things a little bit better? And we think that palliative care paramedics now, with, you know, a couple of years experience of working within a specialist palliative care team, are absolutely the people who can probably help us to prevent some of the avoidable emergency department admissions. You know, and that might be focusing on places like care homes, for example. That might be focusing on community as well. But yeah, so we are developing them into a WAST role, but currently they're generalists in WAST. But if they go to a palliative and end of life care call within WAST, they're going to give a great service, but they're not just targeting those calls at the moment. And when they're within the specialist palliative care team, the way they work is they're kind of off our radar, so they won't respond to 999 calls. They respond to the patients who are already known to the specialist palliative care team, or they will do the urgent new referrals to the specialist palliative care team. So, you know, the CNSs all have their caseloads, the clinical nurse specialists all have their caseloads of patients, and they manage them really, really well. But even the best CNS in the world can't predict everything. No. Things happen. We all know that. You know, people will take a sudden deterioration. Something will happen. A new symptom will present, you know. And actually, for a CNS to have dropped what they're doing in the past to then go and see that one patient, they may have actually had to cancel three or four other visits they were going to do. So the paramedic is supernumerary. So what they do is they don't have any of their own caseload. Basically, they can respond to any of the CNS's patients. So what that does is it puts ours back into the system. So it means the CNS's can carry on seeing all their other patients. The paramedic can go and do the urgent stuff, but they will link in with the CNS or the consultant to make sure the whole team are aware of what's been happening and to set a plan. So it just means more people can get seen in the day, and they can provide an urgent response to patients where previously they might not have been able to do that, because the CNS can't always drop what they're doing. And they might have had to say, actually, you're going to have to ring the GP. And the GP might have said, well, I can't go either. So it'll end up in 999 world, probably. Yeah. So actually, we're now reducing the 999 calls by putting them within a specialist palliative care team.
Again, amazing, isn't it? I'm definitely coming to live in Wales. it just sounds that all of this work that you're talking about is all what palliative and end-of-life care is about. It's all about the values that palliative care embraces, about it's the ethos, and about making sure patients and their relatives have, if possible, the best end that they can possibly have.
Ed, if I may, can I take you back to a point that you made earlier? You spoke about the article that you wrote about just-in-case medications. And in that article, you spoke about the need for having training and how you made the training mandatory. Can you tell us a little bit more about that, please?
Yeah, so Welsh Ambulance recognised the need to make end-of-life care training mandatory, essentially. And that was first brought in 2016. And every year we built on it. So perhaps what you got in 2016 was less than what you get now. But essentially, it's been mandatory since then. And so every grade of ambulance clinician will have education tailored to their needs, if you like. So, you know, the training that we need to do in end-of-life care for perhaps an ambulance care assistant will be around the support that they're giving when they're supporting the end-of-life care rapid transport service. You know, it'll be other stuff as well, but we'll be gearing it for that. Whereas the training we're giving for paramedics will obviously include things like just-in-case meds. So it's tailored for each grade. Our students, paramedics from Swansea University, also get a two-week placement as well as training within their degree. So they'll spend a week in an inpatient setting, which might be a cancer centre or a hospice, and they'll have a week in a community setting. So that might be with a clinical nurse specialist, a district nurse, etc. And so that just allows them to have exposure to, you know, what is palliative care prior to them then getting their registration and becoming paramedics within Welsh Ambulance. But there's also the benefit then to the people that they're working with. So the people who are providing those placements, the hospice doctors, the hospice nurses, the community doctors and nurses, they're learning from the student paramedics as well, because these are paramedics who are in their third year, who've got, you know, a lot of knowledge on the ambulance service already. And so it's kind of a two-way street of learning. So that's been really helpful. And we've also got an awful lot of e-learning that we've built over the last few years. And that was really helpful for when the just-in-case meds did come in. So although paramedics were already accessing patients' own just-in-case meds, when you bring it in vehicle-based, you know, that's slightly different, because there's other things that you need to share, such as using the verbal order process, which is what we had to bring in, because patient group directives, as they call PGDs, they take a long time to bring in. And, you know, we've already said that we brought it in within 2 weeks. So the e-learning allowed us to put in training that way. So we've got sort of videos as well. So some of our consultants in palliative medicine within Wales, it's nothing fancy. They'll just turn Zoom on, press record, and they'll talk to the camera. But we'll upload that then to our e-learning platform, and we get a huge amount of hits on that. So a huge amount of a lot of people will. So the mandatory stuff, obviously, everyone's done. But there's also other stuff if you want to do it, and the number of people doing it, it just shows the appetite that ambulance clinicians have got to learn more about palliative and end of life care, and we're seeing that happening now. So our new paramedics that are coming in, you know, are asking the questions. You know, we're getting emails. You know, when's the next palliative care paramedic recruitment coming up? That's what I want to do. You know, these are the jobs that I now want to go into, and it's becoming a role within the ambulance service that paramedics are actively seeking out. They want to join the palliative care paramedic team, which, you know, what, 3 or 4 years ago, it didn't even exist. So it's great to see that happening.
Sounds like there's been a real shift then in terms of what is passionate towards paramedics is now becoming end of life care.
Yeah, definitely. So as I say, paramedics are now looking actively for the next recruitment for palliative care paramedic role. People are learning more about it within university, and they're wanting to go on the road and be palliative care paramedics, where perhaps traditionally when I joined the ambulance service 20 plus years ago, you know, everybody was one eye on the helicopter. Oh, we want to be a trauma paramedic. And of course, you know, there's still those paramedics, and we need those paramedics, absolutely. But there's more options available now. It's not just, you know, you can either sit on an ambulance or you can go in a helicopter. You know, there's far more options than that. And palliative care paramedic is definitely one people are seeking out.
That's good to hear.
Definitely.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Ed, for your contribution to this episode. It's been really thought-provoking, and I'm sure that when people switch off at the end of the episode, they'll be talking about it for a long time, and hopefully we'll see changes in England. So before we just let you go, we'd just like to just ask you a couple of little questions. One question we would like is, what top tip would you have to help paramedics to survive their shift?
Oh, okay. In relation to palliative and end of life care, or just in general?
Just in general.
Wow. Okay.
I'll put you on the spot.
Yeah. Okay. I guess. So, I mean, if I think when I joined the ambulance service, I'll pass on the top tips that were given to me.
Okay. Right, okay.
So I say a top tip would be to take on board as much education as you can. There are so many people around you that want to help you learn. And don't be afraid to ask questions. And if you're not sure, it's okay to say, I don't know, because there's plenty of people who will help you out. And of course, looking after your own well-being. And everyone's going to have their own version of that. I can't give you an answer to that.
Good response.
It's don't bottle things up.
Yeah, that's lovely, Ed. Yeah, we do have to look after ourselves. And professionals forget that at times. So yeah, that's a lovely tip. Yeah. And also, secondly, before you just go, what do you have in your lunchbox? What's your favourite thing?
Chicken every day of my life. My colleagues in the palliative care paramedic team mock me for it a lot. So I live on chicken wraps. So I'm just obsessed with eating chicken wraps.
Oh, thank you, Ed. Thanks, Ed. Been lovely to speak to you. Absolutely.
Oh, thank you so much for having me in the studio. I've really enjoyed having this conversation. I wish you all the best for all your future podcasts.
Well, we hope you've enjoyed the fifth of our six episodes. Please share your comments via the link in the bio, and we look forward to seeing you in episode six. We're hugely grateful to Macmillan Cancer Support, the End of Life Partnership, and Vista Health for their support in pulling this podcast together.
So it's a goodbye from me, and it's a goodbye from Tessa.
Stay safe out there.